heaven
as I fell down. Welcome to the August 15th edition of Uncle Bobby's Country Corner, where real men don't play. Today is a very sobering day. As you already know, there's so many things going on in the world right now that pertains to how we go about our day-to-day. And subsequently, what I want to do today is kind of drill down on some very key issues as it relates to the African-American experience. And we're going to cross the divide between men and women today to have an intimate and detailed discussion with a young lady from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, who is a graduate of Temple University. She's the president and founder of Demas. Let me make sure I get this right. Okay, Demas Entertainment and Consulting Company. And I'd like to right now welcome to Uncle Bobby's Country Corner, Kathia Woods. Kathia, welcome to Uncle Bobby's Country Corner.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me, and it's nice to be here.
Well, let's kind of dig into how you ended up being a guest on Uncle Bobby's Country Corner. If memory serves me correctly, we had a Twitter interface a few months ago. And you had mentioned then that you would be traveling to Los Angeles in the coming future. And then suddenly, I guess it was Sunday, I heard from you. And it was about what has become a very polarizing figure in some ways, and in other, a very illuminating figure by the name of Jason Whitlock, who has been a recurring guest on Uncle Bobby's Country Corner. And you shared some points of view in terms of what you thought of Jason's perspective. And I decided to take that head on by having you come to Uncle Bobby's Country Corner and kind of share with us your perspective, one, about Jason Whitlock, and then we'll delve into some other issues that I'm sure that you are well versed in. So what prompted you to reach out in the way that you did as it relates to my having Jason Whitlock on my show and his position on many key issues that we deal with on a daily basis?
First of all, again, I want to say thank you for having me on. I just vehemently disagree with Jason on a lot of things. And the crazy thing is, he's 50, I believe. We're 3 years apart, but it's like night and day. You know, he claims to be from the hip-hop generation. I definitely am from the hip-hop generation. I do a lot of work in hip-hop, but in my interpretation and us dialoguing, I get to know a little bit more about you, I have an issue with people of color who get to a platform and become successful and now want to disavow or speak badly about other black people that don't do the dance, you know. That, in other words, in order for us to have, as I like to call it, the plastic fake fold-up seat at the table, because, you know, you can just kick it and hope you are back to where you come from, it's not a permanent seat, is that you have to speak badly about your own. Now, don't get me wrong, when we're out here, you know, committing crimes and causing mayhem, absolutely, we shouldn't turn the other eye. But I do have an issue with him speaking up, especially, like, you know, the main issue that we disagree on vehemently is the NFL, where he's like, you know, it has made millionaires. Okay, yes, it has, but we also got to tell the whole story. We also, at the same point, it has also made a lot of black men ill-prepared to deal with the world. They have these football degrees, like environmental organization type of titles, that don't prepare them to do anything. If they have a degree, they're not prepared to be out in life. That's why the same guys that have a lot of money to ball out end up being broke, end up being destituted, and don't know how to cope in society. We also have to address the fact that 70% of the NFL is black, but they're the workers. They're not the owners. Here we are in 2017, and yes, there aren't as many people of color that are billionaires, but there's a lot of them that are millionaires. And why is it that there hasn't been any people of color that are owners? it's only been about 10 years, if you really want to say it, that we've had African-American head coaches. So for him to be like, we should be so thrilled to be making this money, well, if all the black men in the NFL got a clue and said, we're not going to show up for work tomorrow, because last time I checked, ain't nobody ever bought a jersey because of Jerry Jones or any of the other owners. You come from the talent on the field. So that's where him and I disagree vehemently.
Okay. One thing I know better than to do is put words in anybody's mouth. And it's not in defense of Jason, but one of the things I'd like to have a discussion about is how responsible are white people for black people's self-determination? And I'll use as an example what you just cited. Many of the athletes, in particular in all the sports, are ill-prepared to live the rest of their lives and to manage their resources while they playing to the extent that they can no longer have to deal with poverty. Is that really the owner's responsibility?
No, sir. You're correct. That it's not. And there are a plethora of examples. ESPN 30 for 30 did a very nice feature on football players and football players that have gone broke. And, you know, I'm a huge advocate of saying just because we've got too many athletes that have money for studio time, they want to be rappers and all types of nonsense. And I've always been a huge advocate to say, no, learn how your finances work, learn how the stock market works, learn how to make sure that your retirement account is taken care of so that, you know, your kids can go to college and you can continue to take care of your family. I agree with you in that aspect, but to say that you should just be happy because you can put on a uniform and therefore you shouldn't question management or ownership is ludicrous to me. Like, in corporate America, the reason you have employee relations and you have certain things on diversity is because the employees got together and said, this is unacceptable. And the owner understood by the employees being together, he's not going to be able to run a company, and it's bad for business, that's bad publicity. So I do agree with you that if African-American players weren't just happy with getting a check and would really unite, and the Players Association wasn't some fake organization because they really don't have any power, if they all got together and caught a clue, guess what? The playing field would be a lot level because, again, at the end of the day, nobody comes to see the owner. They come to see the talent on the field. And I agree with you. We got to get out of that mindset to just be happy to be at the party, so to say.
Well, the NFL boycott concept is gaining some momentum. What do you think would be the ultimate outcome in the event that there is, in fact, a boycott of the NFL, good and bad?
Well, I think the one thing is, the gentleman said it on the same network that Jason is on. The owners are, let's be conservative and say, some of the NFL teams are in predominantly black cities, including my city, which is Philadelphia, which is 56.1% brown, including Baltimore, including Chicago, and the list goes on and on. For some strange reason, they're under the impression that people of color are not season ticket holders, that they don't pay for games, they don't pay for parking to have their tailgating, so they're under the impression they do not have to appease that fan base. So if we, and the same thing with the NFL package, which we will not be having in my home, but if we hold back our dollars, because that's really the best way to hit back, then maybe then they'll realize, wait a minute, there is this group of people, because I do agree with Jason. The one thing, if you look at the Nielsen ratings that we have in common with our Caucasian brethren, we watch all the other shows are night and day. But Monday Night Football, Thursday Night Football, they're all in the same spot in the ratings in 1 to 10, you know? So if the NFL then starts to understand we're not just the people wearing the jerseys in the rap video, but we really do contribute, and we as a fan base matter too, then maybe they'll start taking our concerns a little bit more serious. And for me, I think that's a good thing, because just chanting, I think it's great to gather and make your voice be heard, but these owners understand the best message that they can understand, which is dollar sign.
Now, there's no question that they are very cognizant of the economics as it relates to jersey sales in particular, because they're very, very popular, and I see them all over the place anywhere I go in the country. You know, matter of fact, certain artists and certain organizations, particularly gang organizations, you know, adopt certain jerseys and that kind of thing. And the market for NFL memorabilia and merchandise is enormous. I think it would have more of an impact on that than it would actual ticket sales, because most of the time when I watch a football game, the overwhelming majority of people in the seats are white folks. So I don't know how much impact it would have if we just looked at the number of blacks who would, you know, refuse to attend NFL games. But in terms of merchandise, it would be a substantial hit. In reality, though, how many people do you think right now would make that commitment to boycotting the NFL solely on the basis of the fact that Colin Kaepernick has not been allowed to play in the NFL this year?
Sadly to say, I'm not confident that enough. You know what I mean? Time is to tell. To also piggyback on what you said is, last football season, the number one jersey selling was Kaepernick's jersey. And it wasn't just us, as you just stated, right? It was also our Caucasian and other people of other ethnicities that purchased that jersey. So there's definitely some power in that as well, to say, hey, we're still going to buy this guy's jersey, even though right now he doesn't have a home. But, it comes down to what you and I discussed offline. We have to understand and utilize the power of our dollars. You know, the Montgomery bus boycott worked because we overwhelmingly, even though we're considered economically, we weren't the money people, but if we all band our coin together and say, we're not going to participate in this, it made a huge difference. It made a huge difference. And you're right. It's the moment the light bulb goes out for the majority of us, there can really be some changes. But you're right, I don't know, and again, just on the history of our people, I'm not as confident. I can only do my part, which is I am not comfortable at this particular time giving my money to that organization. And we are diehard Eagles fans, we believe green, but at this particular time, I can't support this, just consciously, I can't do it.
You mentioned the Montgomery bus boycott, and that's a good example of one of the few successes we've had by literally using what they refer to as a boycott. In actuality, if people look a little closer to what made that a successful endeavor, was the business community in Montgomery that rallied around the concept of approaching the city of Montgomery and attempting to buy the bus company, which gave them the leverage of saying, we are enough of the population in this city to actually make that particular overture to the powers that be. They didn't sell it to them, but the way they organized that boycott, it wasn't just them not riding the bus. They were able to substitute something that allowed them to move in and around the city the way they needed to by using their own resources. And I wonder if this boycott has been thought out to the extent where there is a plan and a list of demands to the NFL beyond just putting Kaepernick back in the league. What do you know about that? Is there such a plan?
Well, I think, you know, the first thing is they're having the gathering in New York. I think as awful as this past weekend is, I do think you can't ignore it. You can't ignore that there's an issue. You know, we all, as people of color, we know there's always been an issue, but now it's come live and direct from the fallacies on the other side straight to your living room. You'd have to be some type of foolishness to ignore that or to not realize that there is a serious problem. And again, I think it's a combination of the players understanding is We are the product. We are the reason, the majority of us, why there are butts in the seat. And the number two thing is also, like you said, is us as fans to support it. And then, as you stated, to say to the NFL is, okay, you can't on the one hand say we got to give second chances or willing to give second chances to people who have committed criminal atrocities, but then you want to punish the guy who did something peaceful that didn't hurt really, let's be honest, anybody. It might have hurt your feelings or whatever you may think so, but it didn't physically hurt you. You didn't have to go to court over it and all that other business, you know? And you didn't really, it didn't have such an adverse effect. I can't imagine that a peaceful protest has a more adverse effect on you than people that have been accused of murder, beating their wives, and that. That to me is a much harder conversation, unless I'm really out on a limb here. So to me, it's like it's a continuation, but you are right. The protest, really, in my opinion, is a way to get the door open. And you're 1,000% correct. Now you got the door open. Now you got to ask for some stuff, and you got to get some things in writing to say you can't, if you really are allegedly a league about second chances, you can't say that you're more willing to give people a second chance who have committed these heinous things, but you're not willing to give a person a second chance who has been committed of no crime. That is an asinine policy. That doesn't make any type of sense.
I got a question for you relative to the 75% African-American participation in the NFL. What percentage-wise would you think would be the number of players that said, if this brother doesn't get a job, we're not playing?
Unfortunately, I think, I mean, if we looked at it, I would say maybe it would, we'd be pushing it, but we were at 30. And the thing that really offends me even more is that you have the Long brothers, Howie Long's boys, who have been more vocal as Caucasian players than some of these African-American players. You know, we've had some of these retired players who have come out and just said a bunch of foolishness. And they don't realize the reason they had a chance to play at the NFL, because somebody broke that racial barrier. Some of these guys played in the SEC, which was the last conference to integrate. So somebody had to take those lumps. I don't know where the teaching fell off, where these guys think that somebody said, well, you play football well, so we're going to let you play in the National Football League. We're going to let you play in the SEC. No. Somebody has to take those tough lumps so that they can play at Auburn, at Texas A&M, and all that other business. So there's definitely some failure of understanding of history, and there's no excuse for it, because ESPN has run a myriad of programs on that, and we've got Google and Netflix and all that other good business for you to get your knowledge of. So there's definitely some education also that needs to be done.
Well, that segues me into the irony of this being 2017. June the 4th, 1967, 50 years ago, a group of athletes, elite athletes, gathered in Cleveland, Ohio, at the behest of Jim Brown, to stand behind Muhammad Ali in defense of his right, his American right, not to participate in the Vietnam War under the pretext of being a religious person. And they risked everything to do that. And here we are 50 years later, and I haven't seen enough young people understand that you must first have a group of people that, by joining forces, have the leverage to affect change. The absence of that in this instance is a recipe for disappointment and failure, in my estimation. So while we are in the process of thinking about this boycott, I think it's also important to take a snapshot of who's on what side of the boycott. And right now, I don't see enough active players willing to put it all on the line behind this particular issue. So my question to you is, what will be the ultimate outcome if we do not, at this point, have more people engaged, particularly the modern day players, the active players, as well as some of the people from our leadership community? And when I say leadership, I'm not talking about the politicians and the preachers. I'm talking about the people who could capitalize off of the opportunities that are associated with the NFL enterprise, which is a multi-billion dollar business.
What? It's you know, there's a famous saying, all our skin folk and kin folk. We need to stop, you know, we can't shout that Caucasian people are wrong, and rightfully so. When they're wrong, we need to call it out, but can't hold our own to that same standard. Just because someone is the same color as us doesn't mean we have to be blind. So if these certain athletes didn't stand up, or they're speaking the foolishness like Tim Brown has, don't invite them to speak at events. Stop inviting them to the party to have a seat at the table. Yeah, the seat may be only four people, but it's better to have four people that are genuine and that are about change than to have 15 and they're in there for the buffoonery. So we also got to be like, there's a thing in our community, just because somebody knows, can ball out, that we automatically think that they're a hero and a role model. Two different things. If we've learned nothing from OJ, we should have learned that. Just because, great ball player, but that doesn't mean that we're trying to emulate him and elevate him as a role model, and we have to get out of this fantasy world. And I know it's tough, but we got to stop inviting some people, to put it in plain English, to the damn barbecue.
You're from the hip-hop generation, so please share with me some of the figures that you feel should be at the forefront of this initiative outside of Spike Lee, who's closer to my age than he is the hip-hop generation.
Well, currently, I mean, J. Cole just said it when he was in Baltimore. Kudos to him. He has been very outspoken. He went to Ferguson. You know, Nelly went to Ferguson. Even as much as people like to talk about Jay-Z and Beyonce, Jay-Z just bailed out a whole bunch of dads for Father's Day. They went to Ferguson. They supported Black Lives Matter and have been super active. So, you know, that's from this generation. Kendrick has been very open about it. From the old guard, you know, Public Enemy I was in college. Public Enemy got me through college, and Chuck has walked that talk. You know, talking about fight for power and all of this and all of that. You know what I mean?
What is that? Hello? Kathy. Kathy. Hello? Is she still on the line or did she drop? Hopefully she'll call back. The Black Lives Matter thing, I want to ask her a question about that if she returns to the line. I have mixed emotions about Black Lives Matter simply because I'm still trying to find out, beyond focusing on when something happens, like an incident with police impropriety or what have you, what is that all about? Kathy, are you back on the line?
Yeah, I am. I'm so sorry. I don't know what happened.
That's okay. Maybe you're in a position to help me better understand the significance of the Black Lives Matter movement.
Well, Black Lives Matter, from my understanding and my interpretation, came out of the events of Ferguson, which basically were saying, you know, we're tired of people trying to explain away people of color being killed that are unarmed, or, you know, they're not even being allowed to have due process by various cases, especially by Caucasian police officers. And they're basically were like, we've had enough, we are going to speak up, we are going to protest, we are going to gather, and we are going to bring awareness to this subject, because when we are being apprehended for traffic stops, whatever you have there, we end up dead. Nobody should die over a traffic stop. We have people who committed heinous things, and we have, you know, Dylan Roof killed 9 people, and he got taken to Burger King. And he's alive and well to speak about it. So nobody should die. You know, the police job is to apprehend. We have a court system. It's flawed. We still have a court system to do due process. And their whole thing is to bring awareness and to say there's disparities within this, you know. And I don't, they're not a terrorist organization, because anytime black people say we're not cool with something, we automatically are labeled as whatever you want to call it. A lot of people like to say terrorists, but I definitely believe in this particular case, it was just a myriad of things. And those of us that live on the coast, this is something else where I disagree with Jason. This is not a Twitter heresy. I lived in New Jersey before I lived in Philly. New Jersey State Highway Patrol with the racial profiling. That was all going on late 80s, 90s. That was all over the news and newspapers about how black men were being pulled over way more than white men. Black men not being able to catch a cab. Businessmen, CEOs. You know, I remember us being in New York. My father worked on Wall Street. My mom and I having to hail a cab. So these are not things that were coming from our imagination, because, again, they come out of racism. So this is just a myriad of things that, like, you know, I'm sure you've heard this too. The only thing that's changed is we got cameras and we can record it and take pictures and take video of it. That's it. But it's always been going on, you know. So I just believe that they were like an organization of people said we had enough. Something's got to be done. And, you know, as you know, 2016 was just a year where it was going on and going on and going on. It seemed like every other month somebody was dying more than anything, you know. And it's just, I think it's good. Because black lives do matter.
To who?
First and foremost, it matters to us. Because if we don't care, we can't expect anybody else to care.
All right, I'm going to ask you again, to who? Because what I mean by that question, instead of just being a rhetorical one, and this always, you know, kind of spirals into a very hostile conversation with most people, and I don't have that expectation with you. My position is, if you have to wear a T-shirt that says your life matters, then your life really don't matter. And I say that in this context, and it's just a numbers game. Every weekend, there's a number of our people who kill each other senselessly, and there's never the same fervor or outrage at us for doing that to each other. And then when a white person does it, if you're not just outraged about it in a special kind of way, then you're a sellout, you're a traitor, you're a coon, you're Uncle Tom. And I'm still trying to figure out when we're going to, with the same fervor, address something that we're doing to one another. And I'll give you an example. I was in a restaurant the other day, and this young brother came up to me, and he said, "Man, do you have a lighter on you?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I'll be right back. I'll be right back with your lighter, man. I know how people take your lighters, and they don't come back. They don't come back." And I gave the brother my lighter. And he didn't come back. And the first thing I thought was, why was that necessary? Why do we have this inclination to play each other? And it goes back to the slavery experience and the conditioning. And I'm not letting white folks off the hook for none of that. But at some point, my position is this. What white people do is what white people gonna do. The question becomes, when are we going to look at the situation holistically? Because see, it still, you know, eats me up that there has not been justice rendered for Eric Garner, for Trayvon Martin, any of these high-profile cases where, like the brother that got gunned down right in front of us in Chicago. That really just gets at me. But I want to dig a little bit deeper and hold us accountable in both scenarios. And I think that's going to be the ultimate salvation for our people, or the ultimate destruction. How do we figure out a way not to always be victims? And it takes me back to Black Lives Matter We 2 years into Black Lives Matter, and I'm still trying to figure out, beyond waiting for the next, you know, high profile incident and the protests and the lighting the candles, going out, stopping traffic on the freeway, how do we systemically root out the problems that continue to put us in a situation where we are treated unjustly?
Well, to answer some of the question, I think the biggest thing that hurt us when members of a community that are on welfare benefits were forced into public housing. Not in the public housing, aka the project. Because prior to the creation here on the East Coast of these public and just in the inner city of these people who lived in row homes and you got your benefits, the fact that women, in order for them to maintain their benefits, the black man couldn't be in the household. So these are systemic things set up to break up the black family. And we should have fought harder for that. And we need to be continuously more vocal to say, we need our families to be intact. We have a whole generation of boys that are growing up misguided and crazy because in order for the man to be in the household, there are going to be no benefits. So we have to make a decision whether or not we're going to keep the lights on and food on the table. But in order for him to be back in the picture, he's got to have a job that's going to enable him to support his family. So it's a whole setup. Now, let me be clear that in no way whatsoever excuses the black-on-black crime. But as I'm learning, you know, my upbringing taught me differently, but a lot of people are free in body but are enslaved in the mind. Again, I'm not saying that makes it okay. But we got a lot of stuff where we got to teach people, do you understand that these things were implemented to divide us and to push us against each other? You know, like Jay-Z said, we fighting for corners that we don't own.
Well,
and it's just that type of stuff. It's way deeper than that, and a lot of things were put in order, especially when you're poor and you don't have anything and you're living in cramped spaces, and everything around you sucks, to put it in plain English. So what you gonna do? You don't have the energy to go up to Manhattan or where you are, Beverly Hills. So you gonna turn on each other. And it, yes, on paper you look at it, it is psychologically asinine. But that's how the whole wheel, the whole game was set up. We gotta be smarter and step back and say, why is it that they don't want black men in the household? Why is it they want you to be dependent on these things instead of saying, you know what, we're going to give you a hand up, but while you're on this thing, we're going to educate you, we're going to give you some tools, and I don't necessarily mean that everybody should go to college, but teach your trade so that you can get off welfare and the family can be united. See, it is a catch-22. Why aren't we investing to get people off of welfare to get them skills? So that you don't, because I tell everybody that I live in a middle-class neighborhood, why is there nobody running around killing each other? Because you got somewhere to go. You got work. You have a way to take care of your family. You've got benefits. You've got way more to lose. You know what I mean? But when you're already at the bottom, you become desperate, and you're like, you can't. This is already hell. So what am I training in it for? For a different version of hell? So I do think, you know, The problem is way more complicated than just black and white. But we also, like I said, the answer is not killing each other. Because what does that do? We're just feeding another industry, which is the prison industry. And we're still not having black men in our homes.
Well, we're going to take a very short break. And I want to, on the back end of the break, talk to you a little bit about your company. Also, your thoughts on Charlottesville and what the implications of that incident were. And also, women in hip-hop. How are women in hip-hop going to move the needle in terms of how much music influences human behavior? So in a couple of minutes, hang on, and we'll be right back, okay?
Okay, awesome. Thank you.
All right. All right, we're black. That was James Brown. Say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. And it kind of allows me, that song allows me to talk about the impact that music had in my era. It spoke to our condition in two ways. Number one, it called it like it was, and it also encouraged us to take responsibility for our self-determination. So, Kathia, what is it about hip-hop that can connect to the spirit of past generations of people who went on and solved some problems that were social and economic, as opposed to the overriding and overwhelming message that hip-hop has been associated with through its evolution?
Well, I think that's two things. I mean, hip-hop stemmed out of poverty. It comes from the Bronx, New York, during the early 70s, when the Bronx literally was burning, and it came from Black and Puerto Rican people who were at the lowest form of the totem pole. And this was their way of expressing. It came out of an answer to some of the things we talked about earlier today, gang violence, you know. Instead of people rumbling, people, you know, had dance off, and people rapped against each other, which I think we all can agree better than what it was. And that's the whole concept of a crew and things like that. So for me, you know, I grew up like a lot of people, you know, I'm from that Soul Train generation. My parents played R&B and all that stuff. But this was the first music that I discovered. This was the first music that said, okay, this wasn't brought to me by someone older. This was the first time I was like, these people look like me, they're my age, and this spoke to me. So I gravitated to that. I was what you call a record store kid. I was at the record store, and, you know, I would hold chords along with my chords, and we would talk about music, you know. And so that's what the thing is. It came out of people that were discounted, not valued, and all of that. They had to make a way, and this is how they express themselves.
Have you had a chance to listen to The God Box by David Banner?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of David Banner. I'm a huge fan of what he's doing. I think he's a great example for independent artists in this day and age. When people say you can't make music that talks about something, you can't be about something, and your fan base won't ride with you, I think he's a good example that says that's not true.
Well,
you know, because we're all told to do the dance.
You know, it's interesting. We have that common affection for David. I did a show here in Los Angeles called the Zowet Morning Show almost a year ago, and David was a guest. And afterwards, we had enough discussions that we have become friends. And because I am 63 years old, my association with hip hop has left me largely in the dark, because I didn't know the difference between hip-hop and gangster rap, and all of that kind of falls under the same banner, for lack of a better word. And the music took a turn that really frightened me on a certain level, because as I tried to understand, first of all, the electronic piece of it that had replaced instruments, and then the message, you know, I listened to some of the songs and it was misogynistic and in so many ways genocidal to me. I couldn't find the commons and the people who were trying to say something conscious. And then I began to study it a little closer, and I found out that the industry wanted that particular kind of sound and that particular kind of message, and as a result promoted that to the extent where if you really tried to say anything of substance, you didn't get a deal. So where you are as a representative of artists, what is it that you're doing that will kind of, I think, introduce to the population a more hopeful message and a more creative approach to using the music to address social and economic challenges?
Well, to me, hip-hop to me is a culture. The elements of the culture, which are graffiti, which you shouldn't be doing, I say now has become your graphic artist, your videographer, your photographer, the DJ, the B-boys and B-girls, and the MC. That's the elements of hip-hop. The elements of hip-hop were to be community, your brothers and your sisters, to talk about stuff, to uplift, to inform. Now, unfortunately, as all things, as we just discussed, when at the time when it was pure like that, people didn't think it was going to turn into a multi-million dollar business. When I started in it, I was doing it. I didn't know either. I was doing it because I loved it, and it was something that me and my friends were into. We would have flyers, and we would have a party. We would have a good time. Everything was cool. But once this thing started taking off, and to go back to what you said is, when these labels like Def Jam and so forth started, they had black ownership. They had Puerto Rican. They had the people that helped create the culture. When you had, again, I'm from the East Coast, and I grew up with DJ Red Alert and Mr. Magic, the DJ, remember the DJ used to say whether or not a record was hot. Now you've got a corporation telling radio personalities what to play. Basically, you're just a button pusher, because you got to play, in order for you to keep your job, you got to play the nonsense. Even though you would never in a million years say, this is something I like. But you got bills, so guess what? You gonna play the nonsense. And so people, so once you have a record that isn't about anything becoming a hit, now remember, the music people are out the door, they done left, and corporations are now running these labels. They're gonna treat it like the Ford Motor Company. They're gonna run it like, you know, like a machine. This is what we were able to build a car for $5,000, so we're going to keep building more cars. Let's see if we can get it down to $4,000 and sell it for $10,000. And that's basically what happened with hip-hop for the most part. And once you started making hits out of garbage, guess what? It kept going on. And the people that love the culture, that love the culture, are not necessarily in these seats. Now it's all about bling and being seen and being popping on Instagram. However, the underground is still very much alive. It's not as much as it used to be. Like you just mentioned, David Banner, you Public Enemy just dropped a new album. And the crazy thing is, oddly enough, the two guys that had the biggest selling albums the last couple of years were J. Cole and Kendrick, are guys that had something to say. The guys that didn't talk about, I got my chain, I got my girl, and we popping bottles, we doing this. So there, obviously, there is an audience out there that wants to hear things that matter.
Let me ask you something, because you are from a very rich city, musically speaking. I grew up listening to the sound of Philadelphia, and Gambling Huff created a juggernaut of musical messages, from the OJs to Teddy Pendergrass and on and on and on, just tremendous artists, and the music, McFadden and Whitehead, ain't no stopping us now. And it just really inspired a generation of people to deal with the social and economic challenges of that era. What are the prospects of a convergence of the tradition of music being played by musicians and singers conjoining with the hip-hop era? Is there any hope for that happening?
Well, the best example is the Legendary Roots Crew, which is the house band for Jimmy Fallon. Uh-huh. Out of that tree came what they call the neo soul sound, which is music soul child. Shout out to Jill Scott. Shout out to Jasmine Sullivan.
Okay,
they do real R&B music, the instrumental. Questlove said it famously at the Grammy Awards when they won their award for best rap groups. And we're just trying to bring a little musicality to this hip-hop thing.
Mm.
And they definitely have put Philadelphia back on the map. I mean, think about it. These guys are from North Philly. They went to the High School of Performing Arts that are on national TV every night. It don't get no better than that. I mean, everybody from Philly should be tremendously proud. And they come back and they host a festival here called the Roots Picnic every year. You know, that is now become one of the must-see festivals for everybody to attend across the world, not just the nation.
So who do you see emerging in your generation and maybe the generation following you as a part of the leadership class in Black America?
Well, I love what's going on. I was kind of disappointed that Bakari didn't get that seat, but I like what Bakari is doing, and I hope he runs, for office again. I mean, I like Patrick Duvall, who's the former governor of Massachusetts. I think he has some problems. I love Kamala Harris, who is the junior senator out of your state, California. You know, she's a super, together sister that knows her stuff, you know what I mean? And they're really trying to quiet her voice in the Senate, but, you know, she knows her stuff. And so, you know, you're not as black women. You can't quiet us. So there's a lot of, she's not having it. Like, come on. She's an attorney, and she knows her stuff. I love Angela Rye, who's a political commentator, and she's a young woman, and she just started a podcast, and she gives Paris hell on CNN, and she's about her business. She works for Congresswoman Maxine Waters, also an attorney. So, you know, black women are doing it, and they're doing it big, and they're involved, and they are on television, and they're using their platform to talk about the things that you and I are talking about. And they're not just talking about it, but they're working in it, you know. And so it is good to see that there are a lot of good role models for our young girls out there.
Now, you mentioned a lot, mostly, I guess, let me just say, I'm assuming till right now that everybody you mentioned was a Democrat. Is it really, is our future as a people attached to the Democratic Party?
I think, I tell everybody you should you shouldn't blindly put your allegiance to anybody, right? But unfortunately, the madness of coming out on the other side is steering you more to the Democrats. So having said that, it doesn't mean that you're just, like, again, bringing your fold-up chair. Don't let them abuse and misuse your voice or your vote. Make them earn it and make some demands and explain to them that they need you in order to turn this thing around. And in turn for your support, they got to advocate for you. They got to show and prove. And if they don't, you need to go and vote and fire them. We are too content. I had somebody the other day, and I swear to you, and everything that I love, that didn't know that a U.S. senator's term was 6 years. They thought it was two. I said, no, that's your U.S. House of Representatives. So we also got to do some homework before we go into the ballot that we understand what's at stake. Because we currently have a guy here in PA that we're stuck with for 5.5 years. Because folks really didn't take it as serious, because they're like, oh, it's just going to be 2 years. No, we're stuck with him for 5.5 years pending something, bad happening to him. So it does mean we can't just be there. I don't think, as far as the Green Party, I don't think there's enough substance and consistency there for you to throw your weight in for that. But again, I was at the DNC last year, and we just got to be more proactive. And we have to be more proactive in terms of, like, setting the agenda, what the party stands for, and all of those things. What are we running on? And it doesn't start every 4 years when, God forbid, somebody runs for president. It starts when your local city councilman, because those are the people that are responsible for your schools, all that other good business. It starts with your state representative, all of those things. And we got to start knowing who these people are. Like, a lot of people, if you ask them and you said, I can give you $1 million, you can name your city council person, your state representative, your U.S. representative, and your two U.S. senators, it'd be a world of hurt. A lot of people, money, you would be very good. You wouldn't have to pay out a lot of money.
Now, Charlottesville, what's your view on what happened and what are the implications of what happened?
I'm not surprised, because here's the thing, this has been brewing for a minute. We all think, when people think of white supremacy, we think it's some old guy that is bitter from the 60s or whatever. No. When you look at that picture, it was young, college-age people. You have one guy, from what I read, that was the head of their Republican Party, Young Republicans Club, from their university. A lot of these guys are on your college campus, and we got to start thinking that this is something that is some guy who wants the South to rise again, that's holding on to the past. So this is young, for lack of a better term, disenfranchised young white men that are being brainwashed into believing their reason their lives aren't what they are is because of minorities. And when you are a person, as you stated, that can't do for self, and you lack so low self-esteem, or you don't belong to anything, you're easily brainwashed into believing that propaganda. So I'm not surprised. But the thing is, not to say that anything great out of it is, but we now have other white people that were in denial that these things were going on, right? Because we're all supposed to be getting along, we're all living together, we're all working together, we're all hanging out together, that these people were like three or four, they got a wake-up call and realized when they saw the numbers and the vigor of the hate, they now have to be like, okay, we are responsible part of that because we were in denial about it.
So as we are beginning to wind down the show, and thanks again for coming on the show and running the gauntlet with me today, you got a tour that you have been on, and are you still coming to Los Angeles in a few days?
Yes, we are. We are. We're going to be, we have a little stop. We are going to be at A3C, which is the hip-hop festival. We are putting on a show again. We're going to be celebrating all things hip-hop. We're also doing a meet and greet with our brothers out of Boston, Capital Front Booking, salute to them, and we will be out in California to connect. And again, shout out to my brother Planet Asia out there, who's from Fresno. Shout out to my brother Raz Cass, who is from Los Angeles. My brothers out there, good people. Shout out to Lyric Jones and all my peoples out in LA who we've done business with, and through the business we have built friendships. And we're definitely coming out, and we definitely want to build with people, because at this particular point I'm done being enraged, I'm done being mad, I'm done compartmentalizing. We got to come up with some solutions. Can we solve all the world problems? No, but if we can use this thing called hip-hop to bring change and to get people involved, you know what I mean? Like, I'm done with the usual suspects, you, me, and four other people being at the table. We need more people at the table in order to have real change. So I'm definitely coming out to Los Angeles. I was going to come in August, but this thing, A3C, so we'll be coming right after A3C. And to build, and to, again, like I said, is we have a lot of good people out there that we love and have been supportive of us. And like I said, my brother PA been on me and said, you sis, when you going to come out? So I'm going to come be true to my word and build with my brother.
So as we, again, wind down the show today, any parting comments based upon the scope of conversation that we've had today? Is there anything in particular you'd like to impart to my listening audience?
Get involved. Find something that speaks to you. Stop. It's okay to be upset. It's okay to be angry. All of those things are okay. But words without deeds are just that. And stop waiting for someone else to do the work. Get involved, roll up your sleeves. Whether if you're passionate about children, then get involved without that. If you're passionate about the arts, get involved without that. Whatever is your thing, utilize that to help to make our community a little better. And if a brother says or a sister says they need you, stop asking who's going to be there. Just show up. How about we do that? How about we just show up, roll up our sleeves, and get involved? Because who knows, that little bit right there might make the change that we need. So it's on all of us, really, as black people, to continue to work. Because our ancestors went through too much. You know, I mean, I have an 85-year-old grandmother, and I hate to think that she endured and worked for us to have a better life, for us to sit at home and just be like, that ain't my thing, I'm good. We need to do better.
Well, as we close, I've agreed to appear on your show Thursday. Could you tell me a little bit about that format and what the subject matter may be?
Well, here's the thing is, like I said, is we discovered that our community, as we discussed, does not disseminate information the way our counterparts does. We're not necessarily watching CNN, MSNBC. We're not necessarily reading Huffington Post and all that good business, even though we should, to be informed, to be aware of what is going on. So we play music, and, you know, we have music guests on, but we understand our community really does turn to urban radio still to be informed and to be aware. So I want to have you on to our listeners that, because we're an internet show, you can hear us anywhere in the world, that are out in your area, to see if you are in your area, how can you get involved in your area to be a part of the movement forward? Again, it's time for talking has ended. You're involved in some great things. You know, I'd rather you come on, seeing that you're in that area, and say, listen, if you're out in this area, you want to help us do the work, this is how you can get involved. So that's why I want you on, and also because you're a little bit older, and we need our elders, though, you know? We need our elders to remind us that this wasn't just 100 years ago, the fight that you did for us to be able to be lackadaisical, to be on these college campuses like I was in the late 80s and 90s, and all that other good business, for us to sit in these corporations. This is something that we've taken for granted. I mean, I'll say it, if other people in my generation haven't. And we need to be reminded that you all ate a lot of dirt for us to be foolish. So it's time for us to stop being foolish and connect with our elders again and say, how can we continue your work? Or how can we just show up, basically? So I really want you to tell our listeners where they can go when they're out here in L.A.
It ain't just L.A. It's a few more cities that I'm dealing with.
Yeah,
but what's
absolutely.
The name of the show, and what time, and how can they turn in?
It's Cup of Soul Show. We are on PC Radio out of West Philly. And you can listen on the TuneIn app. If you have the TuneIn app, just put in PC Radio. Or you can go to www.pcradiolive.com and listen to us 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Thank you so much for being an engaging guest. And hopefully we'll be able to have more significant exchanges of information and then affect some outcomes. So thank you for stopping by Uncle Bobby's Country Corner. You've been a very illuminating guest, and I look forward to making something happen as a result of this connection, okay?
Absolutely. God bless, and thank you so much for having me on.
Okay. As I close the show out tonight, I'd like to give out a special salute to O.G. Portis. You have no idea what it has taken for her to go from a bare building to a wonderful facility that I'm blessed to operate out of every Tuesday night. And she has a button on her site where you can contribute to the maintenance and the ongoing, existence of this facility. So show some love to OG Portis, because the sister's in it for the long haul, and she's given me an opportunity to stretch my wings and to voice my opinion. And I'd like to thank you for continuing to support Uncle Bobby's Country Corner simply by, you know, your feedback. And at some point, I'm going to cross that divide and be able to expand the show into some other dimensions, because there's so much going on here in Los Angeles that I think people need to be aware of, and more importantly, what they can do to affect social and economic change. So until next week, thank you for letting me be myself again. See you next week.